Doomberg, the green chicken that needs no introduction. How are you today? Thanks for joining me.
Tom, great to be with you. I'm doing just fantastic. Another wonderful day in the coop.
You know, Doomberg, we always tend to have these very interesting, very deep discussions. And I want to start today by asking you what you see as the risks of the molecules, right? The oil, the particular distillate products that we need. What are the risks of those molecules not being in the right form or the right place right now? Has the world adapted well to the energy constraints presented by the Iran war?
Well, it's a bit of a trick answer because it's not really the constraints of the Iran war that are driving the ongoing diesel crisis. It is, in fact, Ukraine's steady attrition of Russian refinery assets, unironically backed at least by the Europeans and maybe even quietly some aspects of the Trump administration. And I say unironically because the Europeans themselves are amongst the most exposed to diesel prices. They, you know, the continent is a net hydrocarbon importer of iconic scale. And so, as we have been warning for many years, and you and I have talked about, like, Russia needs, the world needs Russia's hydrocarbons, and sanctioning Russia's volume was always dumb. And I certainly understand why the Ukrainians, whose country is in the middle of being destroyed, could care less about how much Europeans pay for diesel. Who can blame them for hitting back at Russia in any way that they can? By the way, when we point out that blowing up Russian refineries is bad for global diesel prices and is what's causing global diesel prices to rise, that's in no way making light of or excusing what Russia's doing. I think Russia is purposely destroying Ukraine and making it unlivable ahead of the winter. And I saw a great podcast today on Canadian Prepper, who's the guest whose name escapes me, but very thoughtful guest who spoke with precision and care. And he said Russia's goal is clearly to depopulate Ukraine and to trigger a refugee crisis in Europe. And so that being said, blowing up refineries makes crude cheaper, all things being equal, and makes refined products expensive, all things being equal, and the diesel crisis being driven by that, first and foremost. The closure of the Strait of Hormuz, the ongoing risks of escalation in the Middle East are certainly contributing factors. Your question was on molecular flexibility, and our standard answer is all crises eventually lead to dampened future crises, and the world will adjust to this one just like it always does. And we're beginning to see those adjustments now. The U.S. refineries running at full speed, the deal with Venezuela, which I'm sure we'll talk about, all manner of fungibility investments made by China, all those things are already helping make what historically would have been a true severe crisis, losing 15% of global diesel, seaborne diesel, is more manageable. It's annoying. You're not seeing stockouts yet, but you are seeing elevated prices. You're seeing inventories being drawn down. And we're one refinery explosion away from, you know, a big deal. And those happen, by the way, when you run at 98% utilization or 102% in the U.S. Gulf Coast, or whatever the number is. Mm-hmm. So the flexibility is already there, and these occasional spikes always drive more investment in flexibility, which over time then makes everything more fungible. Mm-hmm.
So in a lot of ways, it seems very ironic that the world is still so dependent on Russia, not only for diesel, which they've recently, I guess, you know, in the last couple of weeks, stopped exporting, but how is not only Ukraine, but also basically Europe's the ability of themselves or the ability for them to heat through this coming winter so tied to Russia still?
You know, forget why, than it is was plainly obvious. We were writing about it in 2021. Like, these are things you have to consider before you go down the path of war. Mm-hmm. And one of the great mysteries of the 2020s, I will say, is this lost recognition that Russia is a great power. You could hate Putin. I'm no big fan. You could be a Russiaphobe. You could think that, you know, Russia is all manner of evil and a great geopolitical foe of the Western-based international rules order-based order, whatever Kaya Kallas is blabbing about today. But to just proceed as though Russia is not a great power, and I don't mean great as in like one to be admired. I mean great as in amplitude, size, efficacy of its capacity to project power. Russia's a great power. It has the world's largest, most sophisticated nuclear weapons arsenal. It launches things into space. There's a very small number of countries that you can count probably on one hand that have a active space program. It's a strong power. It's probably not at the level of the US and China, but it's not that far behind. It's producing weapons at a rate that is embarrassing NATO. And when the war started, Europe acted as though it had no dependencies on Russia and it could just cut them without consequence. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you could pull up the Statistical Review of World Energy in 2021 and see the flow of natural gas from Russia to Europe, the dependency of crude oil imports to the refineries of Europe, and say, gee, you know, Putin is talking about an alternative security arrangement for Europe. Instead of just dismissing this out of hand, let's go ahead and choose the path of war. Let's send Boris Johnson into Kiev and torpedo the Istanbul negotiations. And so here we are. Like, to point that out is not to be a Putin puppet. It's to be a realist. Mm-hmm. And so now, as Putin said, you know, you've made your bed, now lie in it. Russia is going to still be a global energy producer of consequence. India is still going to need them. China is still going to welcome them with open arms. It must be said that Trump's clownish posts on social media don't help the U.S. cause. They embolden the geopolitical opponents of the U.S. to convince others that there is a need to diversify beyond the U.S. dollar system. It plays right into the hands of Putin and Xi and the North Koreans and the Iranians. You know, I've saw lots of commentary about the U.S.-Canada trade war. Like, if you're pissing off the Canadians, you're kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel of people that you need to be pissing off in the world. I mean, let's be honest with ourselves.
I was going to say, especially considering how much oil that still gets exported to the U.S.
Well, that's the great irony is that the U.S. geopolitical heft is aided by the fact that Canada has nowhere else to send its oil, and the U.S. gets to gorge on it at a huge discount. So technically, in dollar terms, there is a trade imbalance between the U.S. and Canada that is on paper in Canada's favor. You take out the oil, and suddenly that which looks like a deficit becomes revealed to be an incredible source of strength that you lament having been taken away from you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all these things are temporary. Even Trump, you know, his time in office, his arc as a political force will eventually come to an end one way or the other. And how you behave now and what you say and what you write in our case and, you know, what you do as politicians really matters. History has a longer lens than the current news cycle. So we shall see. But, you know, to your question of like, how could it be that still right now? So we wrote a piece called A Minor Detail a couple of weeks ago. The subtitle was something like, incredibly, it is Putin who will decide whether Europe freezes this winter. Mm-hmm. Like, the marginal cubic meter of natural gas going into Europe does so through a pipeline under the Black Sea to Turkey from Russia. Two of them, actually, TurkStream and BlueStream. And the Russians could shut that off tomorrow. That they don't is a source of great controversy inside of Russia. Putin is too weak. He's too meek. Is the lament of Putin in Russia. And look at landed LNG in the Dutch TTF terminal today as we're talking. It's $24 a million BTU or some crazy number. Just to give you the equivalent number in the U.S., Henry Hub is like $3 a million BTU. No wonder German industry is going under, rolling up shop, moving to China, firing workers. No wonder populist parties in Germany are on the cusp of taking power in Eastern Germany, assuming that, you know, Friedrich Merz allows the election to go forward here in like 3 days. All of this is explained by energy. We've been ringing this bell for the full 5 years that Doomberg has been a publication. And yet when it happens, you know, having pointed it out wins you no credit, you know, it's just really amazing, you know, kind of sad actually to see, but you know, here we are.
So how does the geopolitics of energy kind of inform us about what the possible end to the war in Ukraine could be?
I mean, the war in Ukraine and its end could only ever be through the military imposition of an outcome by Russia. This has been known for years. And anybody who says that the tide is turning, or, you know, if only the Russian people could be made to feel more pain, they're just lying to you. Like this thermodynamics dictates that this war was always going to be won by Russia. Because again, you can only assume that a deindustrialized NATO from a distance can keep a military fighting toe-to-toe with Russia in its own backyard. That you can only come to that crazy assumption by assuming that Russia is not a great power, that it's a gas station masquerading as a country or whatever. Anybody who's done business with Russians, who knows Russia, who's been to Russia, knows that that's just like happy talk of know-nothings. Again, you hate Russia all you want, but, you know, walking into a bar and there's a guy at getting a beer in a Hell's Angels jacket with a bunch of tattoos and muscles the size of my head, well, I'm not going to say, you know, that person's not a powerful person. Like, this survival instinct has to kick in at some point. Like, Russia is a great power. It could wipe out London and Paris and Berlin in an hour with the push of a button. Like, that has to be an input into your analysis. And like, it's just borderline suicidal for it not to be. Like, this used to be recognized. This used to not be controversial. There's like the Helsinki agreements and summits and mutually assured destruction and, you know, great power diplomacy. That all began with a recognition that, yes, the Soviet Union, communist Soviet Union, was a arch enemy of Western capitalism. But like World War II proved, that fighting things out on the battlefield, A, doesn't always end up with you winning, and B, is never good for humanity. So maybe there ought to be an overt attempt at diplomacy. Anyway, people will rewrite history and say all kinds of nasty things in your comments, so I apologize in advance. But I don't know. It just seems utterly knowable in advance. Like, yeah, hey, Europe, you are way too dependent on Russia to go to war with Russia. Hey, the U.S., you're way too dependent on China to go to war with China. I'm sorry. But like, the U.S. military-industrial complex cannot compete with China because it is reliant on it. Mm-hmm. Like, again, this is not blasphemy. This is not traitorous. It's an observation, an agnostic, realistic observation of the is state. Now, hey, if you want to change that is state, go for it. Understand why you need to change so that you can then discover what you need to change and get busy doing it. But here we are.
You know, Doomberg, you have come up with several mental models on how to think about the let's say the capabilities and or risks involved with going to war with Russia, you know, many of these different current geopolitical risk states, let's say. And you came up with a mental model on how Russia could start actually testing to see how many missiles that Ukraine still has to defend themselves. So originally, I believe you were saying that Russia, once they kind of recognized that Ukraine was running low and or out of missiles to defend itself to airstrikes, has that mental model worked for you?
Sure. So let me give you a bit more context, because I think I may have said it on a podcast and we've not written about it yet. And by the way, like, there's things we believe, things we'd say on a podcast, and things we'd write, and that is a narrowing pyramid. Mm-hmm. We try out all kinds of lines on podcasts. By the way, we'd never say or write anything we don't believe. But by the time it gets written under the masthead for our paying subscribers, there's a different lens that we apply to it. So what have we been observing? So we look for open source intelligence. We follow pro-Ukrainian mappers. We follow pro-Ukrainian Telegram channels and pro-Russian mappers and pro-Russian media and alternative media and traditional media and the Kremlin's website and the Kiev Independent. And I think that's the first thing, is like, you got to read everything. So we started picking up through one of the mappers we follow, who is at least headline relatively pro-Ukrainian, but seems to call it down the middle. This website, AMK Mapping on Twitter. Maybe you've seen him. No idea who he is. Doesn't matter. He's a reasonably good input for predictions, which is the main score for us. And he started noticing that Ukrainian fighter bombers were flying closer and closer and closer to Ukraine, almost as though they were testing whether, because, you know, Patriot missiles aren't just used to shoot down incoming missiles. They're actually better for shooting down, you know, piloted military aircraft. And this is the reason why, for example, even the U.S. in the war with Iran was hitting Iran predominantly with standoff munitions. What does that mean? It means you're a safe distance away from, you know, anti-aircraft missile defense. And if Ukraine is truly without anti-aircraft missile defense, that is a profound shift in the war that is now just beginning to be recognized in legacy media outlets like the Financial Times. So these planes are flying close and there's not a Patriot being fired in response, and they get closer and closer and closer. And now just this week, you know, Russia has sealed off the Black Sea to Ukraine. Few over here understand what that means. As part of the mission to seal off and to make Ukraine a landlocked country, Russia has been blowing up the port of Odessa. And in the past few days, sources that we trust report that for the first time, the Russians have used glide bombs on the port of Odessa. Well, why does that matter? And why am I telling you this story, this wind up to the answer? That matters because they feel comfortable flying piloted aircraft close enough to drop these catastrophically large bombs, which make the impact of missiles de minimis by comparison. These bombs weigh up to as much as 3,000 kilograms, glide bombs, and they're relatively accurate, especially when dropped from close distance, which is why if you remove the Patriot missile shield and suddenly Russian pilots feel emboldened to fly directly over Kiev, which we've not yet seen, you could see how very quickly that kind of dominance of the sky leads to a rapid collapse. If the U.S., for example, could have flown over Iran unmolested and dropped similar types of ornaments on Iran, the war in Iran would have gone very differently. It's because the U.S. was limited to standoff munitions, and because those munitions were in short supply, that the U.S. military ended up in the situation that it did. And so, as another proof point along the journey, glide bombs in Odessa catches our attention. That's a mental model, right? That is like a set of premises that predict. So the original premise that these pilots were testing air defense systems is predictive. It's still operative. It has a chance to graduate to a mental model. Mm-hmm. Running against that is two things. Zelensky has been pounding the table correctly that he needs Patriot missiles. And it sounds like he got a fresh batch of some of them, because in the last few days, there has been reports, again, from mapping sources that we trust, that have earned some semblance of trust, that at least some Patriot missiles were fired at some of the missiles. There's always an argument about whether those missiles were intercepted. And so Ukraine is now in possession of some Patriots again, which then at least puts off the time where Russian fighter bombers fly freely at relatively low altitude, crisscrossing around Ukraine with no concern about being shot out of the sky. But when that day comes, so like, what is the real, the way we think this whole lateral thinking approach, like the day a credible source provides evidence that a Russian Air Force plane dropped a bomb, not a missile, on Kiev, that's a step change. Mm-hmm. So then how does that work in our process? We'll see that in the open source. And it won't make the news for like 10 days. So that's a 10-day edge where our readers or us, our team, know that a phase shift has occurred that the media just hasn't caught up to yet, and or doesn't want to admit to, or lives in denial of, depending on the country and their media that we're talking about. So a great example of this. Our open source analysis, and that sounds fancier than it is. It's just a series of YouTube, Twitter, Telegram accounts that have proved valuable as sources of information that help us predict. One of them started to flock that Ukraine had begun assaulting grain ships in the Sea of Azov. This was in July. And we're like, wow, that's quite a weird escalation for Ukraine to do, because this whole grain deal that was brokered by the UN and Turkey in 2022 that Putin got an awful lot of heat for signing on, that Ukraine and Europe subsequently reneged on, but Russia sort of kind of kept its end of the bargain and didn't shut the port of Odessa, and all these weapons have been pouring into Odessa. And we see this attack on the Sea of Azov, oil ships, grain ships, pick your favorite. And we're like, wow, if that's true, that's kind of dumb, because this is going to be the great smokescreen for Putin to overreact and to finally seal off the Black Sea, as his opponents domestically have been calling for. And so we then went over to the pro-Russian channels, and sure enough, Russians were lamenting about the attack in the Sea of Azov and its effectiveness, and saying that the Russian government was minimizing it for now. Well, that confirmed to us that the attacks were real, that they were on a newsworthy scale. It wasn't just one-off. This was a systematic new campaign. And so while the press was catching up a few days later and cheering on the Ukrainians, we're already on to the next prediction, which is, wow, wouldn't want to be in Odessa. And sure enough, look what's happened to Odessa. And now there isn't a country in the world that's complaining to Russia about sealing off Ukrainian grain exports. Even India and Brazil and the other BRICS partners of Russia that had been cautioning Putin against taking such measures have nothing to say because of this campaign against the Sea of Azov. Now, I say that not just because of information flow and mental models and how to predict, but again, back to this point, wherever Ukraine has tried to escalate, Russia reacts 5 to 10-fold, which is just proof that they have escalation dominance, and they also have the ultimate escalation dominance, which is nuclear weapons, which Iran does not have versus the U.S., which changes the nature of that negotiation versus this one. And so what does this mean when we see now Zelensky post this remarkable thing on Twitter about he's going to shut down Russian airspace and no civilian airliner is safe? And a good look, I totally understand. I'm empathetic to the anger, the frustration. I don't know if you saw the related video where he was going off with justifiable anger about how every European diplomat is on vacation in August. And he's like, I get it. Like, you like your vacation, but my country's being destroyed. What the hell are you doing? Mm-hmm. Totally predictable. Totally understandable. Zelensky saying he's going to knock out Russian civilian airliners. Well, I can tell you, and Putin said, but since nobody listens to Putin in the West, I can tell you what Putin said and what our interpretation of it. He said, look, God forbid that happens because the consequences are going to be incredibly dire. So I wouldn't want to be in Kiev right now, especially if a drone hits a wing of an aircraft, of a civilian aircraft filled with 300 passengers. If you're Zelensky, yeah, they need to feel the pain of the war. I get it. Totally understandable. But at the same time, the boomerang comes around. And if you want to talk about the gloves coming off, a civilian airliner being shot out of the sky in Russia right now would result in a dozen Oreshniks knocking out the decision-making centers in Kiev on a scale that the world has not seen. That's like the base case. So just put that on the board of like predictions if we see. Now, by the way, the threat itself is very dangerous, what Zelensky did, because now you're open up for a false flag. Imagine some hardcore right-wing Russians want to force Putin's hand to drop nukes on Berlin. They'll take their own plane out of the sky and blame it on Zelensky. It's a very dangerous time right now. The world has never been more precarious, susceptible to a false flag. MI6 decides they're going to provoke Putin and take a plane and put the blame on Zelensky, you know? Who knows? Don't be naive to think that that type of stuff doesn't happen and people don't think that way. And so now we're in an incredibly dangerous time, like scary, right? I mean, and again, to think that the oceans separate us here in North America from the long-term effects of this is naive. So anyway, here we are. So,
well, it's interesting, as you said, the idea of feeling pain. I want to get your sense on how, or you know, feeling pain and attacking a country that you're still very reliant upon. So,
yeah,
as an extension of the Iran-US conflict here. When Besant came out and was talking about the idea of sanctioning Iran more effectively than they already have, and I say that very tongue in cheek, one would think that obviously China doing trade with Iran is under threat by these new rules, quote unquote, imposed by these sanctions. So how do we try to wrap our minds around the idea that if China is doing so much trade with Iran, that the US is actually going to take steps against China as part of that sanction package?
It can't. That's what makes it all a farce. Mm-hmm. Good luck to the tenure, you know. Besant was asked at his press conference, and he even said it, which is amazing to me, which is, why haven't you sanctioned China? It was like the only question reporters kept asking him, and then finally said, because we didn't want to blow up the financial system. Well, then who's the hostage? Right? I mean, who's got the leverage? Who has the escalation dominance? It's China. Why? Because they have a monopoly on rare earths. They have a monopoly on everything the U.S. military industrial complex needs to prosecute war. The arsenal of democracy is China, to borrow a line from World War II. China makes everything. The reason why we've been saying that industrial might is a proxy for your energy might and military might is a proxy of or a derivative of your industrial might, China works hard to be as energy independent as it can be. Europe is a flaccid energy vassal. What is Europe doing thinking it could provoke China or dictate China anything? Or Russia? At least the U.S. is energy abundant. And the U.S. is still a great power. But for Besant to say we're going to crush Iran when 80% of Iran is China and exempt China, it makes a farce of the whole thing. And by the way, every time they do that, Every time Trump posts something on Truth Social, every time Bessent goes on CNBC and makes fun of Mark Carney, a little bit of a brick at the bottom of the wall of U.S. dollar supremacy gets pulled. Mm-hmm. Somebody somewhere hedges. Somebody somewhere decides maybe having China custody their gold is not such a bad thing. The people participate at the SCO meeting this week, even though it's not covered. That's half the world's population and their leaders sitting in one room. It happens. Drip, drip, drip. So every failed attempt to choke off Iran means the rest of the world is more resilient. And eventually we'll wake up one day and it'll be over. And people will scratch their heads and say, how did that happen? How did it happen so quickly? Look, the U.S. dollar hegemony is at its core a game of confidence. And all confidence games have runs eventually. And China's just sitting there biding its time. You know, when Trump visited China, Xi gave Trump what I think internally in China was perceived as an incredible slight. They walked past, you know, the great imperial palace, wherever it was, and there's a tree there planted in this garden that's older than the U.S. itself. And Xi brought Trump by and pointed that out, as if to say, like, you know, give it some time. This too shall pass. Your time in front is coming to an end. The kind of thing that was wildly overlooked in the Western press, but I think is symbolically very important to the current situation. So when I see Bessent, I mean, look, he's highly entertaining. He's a very smart guy. Who am I to argue? He's the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States. He's clearly far more accomplished than me or you or anybody we know. Standing up there with his sunglasses on, berating the press for believing a regime that lies, referring to Iran, like with a straight face. I mean, it's just incredible. It's truly, it's almost like we're living in a simulation.
I keep saying that in a group text with two friends, like this is the worst possible simulation. And I think, you know, another example of that is the recent speech by Warsh talking about hiking near Jackson Hole, just to, you know, throw that out for the algorithm.
Right? I mean, give him full credit for sense of humor. It was kind of funny.
Absolutely. But the idea that comes back to the simulation that we're living under is
yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you wanted to make a farce of the efficient market hypothesis, I suppose that would be one way to do it. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this idea of aligning with maybe weaker countries and or taking your diversification of optionality off the table, it seems like Canada is really throwing themselves headlong into this idea of aligning with Europe rather than the US. And this is something that you've been writing about from a very interesting vantage point. So why do you think it is that Canada is so, or Canada under Carney is so focused on aligning themselves with arguably a more bankrupt state than the US?
That's only half the strategy. Mm-hmm. He is diversifying the export customer base of Canada to include Europe and, most importantly, China. The focus is on Europe because, and, you know, we're not immune from it, you know. Ursula makes for great copy. But the diversification matters much more to China. And when you look at what broke up the negotiations, allegedly, who knows, we're not in the room, was the U.S. desire to impose upon Canada the ability to veto effectively Chinese investments on Canadian soil, especially in critical infrastructure and pipes and highways and things like that, dams and bridges, who knows. Which, of course, Canada recalled that because Canada considers itself a sovereign country. That's risky. So, you know, I just spoke in front of a Canadian audience and spitballing a few things that we haven't written yet, but I'll say it on a podcast, back to my earlier comment. When you're a junior country next to a superpower, that's a very dangerous thing to be, potentially. Mm-hmm. And the analogy that I would use right now for the decline of U.S. hegemony is kind of like the breakup of the Soviet Union, in a way. It's not a perfect analogy, but, you know, is it predictive? Well, let's see. So there are three countries surrounding Russia, the survivor state of the Soviet Union, that took decidedly different paths. So on one extreme is Ukraine, which took a confrontational path with Russia. I don't think that's a judgmental axiom. It's just true. They're at war with Russia. It's hard to get more confrontational than a war. And on the other side is Belarus, you know, Belarus, who hugs Putin and Russia, like all the way on the other extreme, right? And in between is Kazakhstan. So Kazakhstan's an interesting country, landlocked, welcomed Western investments. Chevron's there, Exxon's there. Lukoil was there alongside them. They tried to thread the needle. They still needed Russia, a pipeline out to the Black Sea, you know, the CPC pipeline, which we wrote about. They kind of thread the needle. They respect Russia. They keep good relations with Russia. But they express sovereignty in a way that doesn't threaten Russia. Now let's come to North America. And prior to this year, you kind of had mirror images of each of those examples here. So the Ukraine of the Western Hemisphere was Venezuela under Chavez and then Maduro. And the Belarusia of Western Hemisphere is Guyana, or we like to call it the 51st state of Exxon, you know. And then you have Canada, which the mental model, you know, the theory we've been spitballing internally is sort of the Kazakhstan theory of Canada. So can Canada maintain and express its sovereignty in a way that is not overtly threatening to a declining U.S.? And that's the needle that Carney needs to thread. If anything, he's probably gone about as far as he should with this latest round of trade negotiations, playing the gambit that Trump is temporary and the midterms are coming, one suspects. And also recognizing that he needs Orange Man Bad to get the pipelines built, which we've been writing about, as you know, since 2024. But you don't want to go too far either. Ask Maduro. And so we're seeing now, in a arguably far, far superior way to the Russians vis-a-vis Ukraine, how the Americans are reshaping Venezuela to their liking. Whatever you think of the snatching of Maduro, and we think it was obviously outrageous. It was bloodless. Life has moved on in Venezuela. They've had the earthquake. This new deal, contrary to the storm of criticism that Trump has received for it, we wrote about it relatively positively in the most recent piece we published before this appearance on your show. Compared to the mess that Russia's going to have to deal with for decades in Ukraine, even when they quote-unquote win that war, the Venezuela operation looks surgical by comparison. And so Canada, if it could pull off of Kazakhstan and wait Trump out without poking the bear, probably a prudent way to go.
So does this really actually help unlock Canadian energy? And do you think that, you know, considering how long it takes to build some of this infrastructure, you know, a Canada-wide pipeline, let's say, for example, do you think that ends up, you know, getting rid of or fast-tracking a lot of the regulatory red tape that's in place?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's the whole point. That's the theory. Like, if Canada really wanted to, it could build a pipeline in a year, mm-hmm. right? It could just add another one to the existing one. and get it out to the Pacific Ocean and add another million barrels. It could do it in a year if it had to. Mm-hmm. So the fact that it doesn't is a choice. Has there ever been a frenzy greater than now for Carney to propose such a project? As we said in the piece, you know, that we published last week on this subject matter, like, can I interest you in a Sir John A. Macdonald molecular highway? You know, wrapped in a thicket of patriotism. The piece was called the Maître Nous, which is, you know, masters in our own house, the classic rallying cry of Quebec separatists. And so here we are, like, you know, so if we're right, you know, there will be some compromise reached and Trump will get a face-saving way. And by the time Trump is gone, because Trump is temporary, the midstream assets will be built, and midstream assets are best modeled as immortal. So do what you have to do to get them built without pressing the button, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm.
Just a quick aside for listeners here. I have been trying to remain listener supported here. So if you go to Substack, there's going to be a new section for subscribers only, where we have a bonus section or bonus round of questions from every interview that's available to Substack subscribers. Please go check it out. It's $12 a month or $120 a year you can join for, which works out to $10 a month. I really want to remain independent, and this, of course, helps us continue with the show and continue to remain independent. Short of that, please like, subscribe, share the show. We're almost at 10,000 subscribers on YouTube. I really appreciate the support. Thank you, everyone.